Charlie had seen how even the liberal Manhattan elite dealt with publicly ostracized communists in their midst, and it wasn't pretty. Sociology lecturer Bernard Stern saw his name dragged through the mud, not only by the McCarthy Committee, but by the university. Anthropology lecturer Gene Weltfish had been dismissed altogether. And these weren't individuals accused of espionage. Their transgressions had been in thought and belief. There was no escaping the stink of the Red Scare. Kefauver eyed Charlie's seduction of the innocent on the coffee table. "With regards to the juvenile delinquency hearing," he said, "have you lined up the courthouse for us?" "Not yet. Working on it. Dr. Wortham is a good man. I had lunch with him last week in New York." "Sir, have you read this book?"
"Read it?" asked Kefauver. "I helped pay for it. Steered federal funding so he could diagnose this scourge. My God, Charlie, when Hendrickson and I started the subcommittee on juvenile delinquency last year, we had Dr. Wortham in mind the whole time. Something has got to be done about this epidemic, even if we just shine a spotlight on it like I did with organized crime."
Charlie was silent. The muscle that kept him from expressing his thoughts and principles was getting quite a workout. Kefauver pointed at a framed magazine article hanging on the wall to Charlie's right.
"Read that," Kefauver ordered. "It's from Life."
Charlie obediently stood and examined it. "The week of March 12, 1951 will occupy a special place in history," the article read. "The U.S. and the world had never experienced anything like it. Never before had the attention of the nation been so completely riveted on a single matter. The Senate investigation into interstate crime was almost the sole subject of national conversation."
"Impressive, sir," Charlie said. "But, Charlie, do you know how many people watched Frank Costello testify before my committee?" Kefauver asked.
30 million.
"That's even more than watched your Yankees win the World Series."
He smiled, a big, goofy cornball grin, so wide and uninhibited that his molars were almost visible.
"Now, you're no Mickey Mantle, Charlie, but you might have a chance at becoming the next best thing."
Chapter 10. Saturday, February 27th, 1954. Georgetown, Washington, D.C. For the first time in weeks, Charlie found himself facing a Saturday and Sunday with no work plans, no receptions or cocktail parties, no hearing preparation or research, so he was determined to make the weekend enjoyable for him and Margaret. On Saturday morning, he surprised her with breakfast in bed. Toast, eggs, bacon, coffee, though her lingering morning sickness meant most of her bites and sips were in the name of love, not hunger. He settled next to her on the bed and opened up Friday's Washington Star. "Should we see a movie?" In New York, they saw films so often it didn't matter which one they picked on any given night, since odds were they'd see another within the week. But since moving to Washington, they hadn't been to the cinema once. Margaret nodded but patted her still small belly and said,
"I'm asserting my right to pregnancy veto."
Charlie rolled his eyes playfully and checked the listings.
"How to Marry a Millionaire," Charlie read.
"That's with..."
Margaret paused and then whispered breathlessly,
"Marilyn Monroe?"
She put her finger on her lips, widened her eyes.
"Baby girl, so confused."
All right," Charlie said, smiling, well aware of Margaret's aversion to Miss Cheesecake 1951,
an aversion he didn't share, but now was not the time to press the issue. He glanced at the next ad. "Hondo, starring John Wayne."
"Ugh,"
she said. 2 years before, Wayne's Big Jim McClane depicted him as a heroic agent of the House Un-American Activities Committee, with cameos by actual HUAC members. Ever since, Margaret had considered him a propaganda puppet of the more jingoistic drum majors in the U.S. Congress. "The Wild One with Brando, that's a no," he announced. Charlie found Brando, and indeed the whole belly-scratching, teeth-picking, method-acting school, mumbly and contrived. "What's A Lion Is in the Streets about? Cagney's in it."
"I think it's about a crooked politician."
"No politics, thank you," Charlie said. "The Robe with Richard Burton?" Margaret leaned closer to Charlie and looked at the ad.
"Looks religious," she said. Let's see something fun. We can do Piety and Suffering some other time.
That left Roman Holiday, a romantic comedy with Gregory Peck and a newcomer named Audrey Hepburn. Margaret was not only excited to get out of the house, but touched by Charlie's effort. Both on their best behavior later that evening, after a lazy, comfy day at home, they walked hand in hand to the nearby cinema. They'd opted for the Calvert Theater, a classic movie house with luxurious and spacious seating. He put his arm around her as soon as the Paramount Pictures Mountain logo appeared on the screen, and she accepted it, nestling into his chest. He patted her tummy.
"I'm glad the rabbit died," he whispered. "That's such a strange saying," she whispered back. "The rabbit dies no matter what. They inject my urine into the bunny. A few days later, they open the bunny to inspect her ovaries."
"Bunny dies either way?"
"Bunny dies either way."
They enjoyed the film, though they agreed that the what-might-have-been ending was unsatisfying. Charlie didn't mention to Margaret that he'd grown a bit uncomfortable at the moral dilemma presented to the Gregory Peck character, who opts to do the noble thing. Was Charlie choosing the same path? But he'd shaken off the discomfort and lost himself in the charm of the film. Afterward, they retreated to Martin's Tavern, a small Italian bistro on Wisconsin Avenue, where they ordered veal piccata and a carafe of Chianti. They were trying to remind themselves of what they enjoyed about each other outside of the newly hectic tenor of their D.C. life. 10 days before, Charlie rushed home after the Defense Appropriations Bill markup, excited to show his skeptical wife that his strategy had worked, that the money for Goodstone had been deleted in the latest draft. But even though he raced red lights and arrived home by 6:30, Margaret had already fallen into a deep sleep on the couch. The next morning, still eager to share his news, Charlie headed into the kitchen, only to find Margaret furious. The day before, she'd learned that Gwinnett's research team had returned to Nanticoke and Susquehannock Islands without her. Her encounter with Teardrop the Pony was the most noteworthy event in all their research.
"But of course, my being a woman, and one with child no less, all but erases that," she fumed. "Can't wait to see what gender pronouns are used to describe the researcher's encounter with the pony in the final published work."
Charlie tried to be sympathetic, and he realized that this wouldn't be the moment to share his own professional triumph. He left for work feeling vaguely disgruntled, and it wasn't until a day later that she asked him about Goodstone. By then, he'd built up a head of righteous petulance and didn't answer, even though he knew it was childish, and the simmering tensions between them continued. Tonight, however, they were both trying to put aside the resentments they'd let fester, and as soon as they had their first sips of wine, she brought up the appropriations bill. She reached across the table to hold his hand.
"Proud of you," she said.
He would have proposed again right there if he'd had a ring. "It was great," Charlie said. "I was trying to keep a low profile, but during the markup, Chairman Carlin took a moment to thank all the veterans for our service and for sharing our experiences with them. The other guys on the committee applauded. It was really nice."
"And the appropriation money for Goodstone is gone?"
"Gone with the wind," Charlie said. "The provision was literally X'd out. A line struck through the whole paragraph. And on the floor of the house later, a bunch of the vets, Strongfellow, McLachlan, Sutton, Street, all patted me on the back. Highlight of the year." He caught himself. Margaret had told him she was pregnant in January. "In terms of Congress, I mean," he added. The tavern was full of revelers, Georgetown University students, professionals whose post-work happy hours had morphed into sloppy dinners, married couples trying to catch up after busy weeks. It was dark, the restaurant's maroon ceiling and oak floors providing little reflection from the hanging chandeliers and candles on each table. Waiters bustled in and out of the kitchen, ferrying hamburgers, oyster stew, and hot browns to customers, while the saloon seemed almost like an assembly line for martinis. Margaret rested her elbows on the table and ticked off the names on her fingers.
"Strongfellow is the OSS guy on crutches. McLachlan, or Mac, is the minister from Indiana. Sutton is the conservative Democrat who's challenging Kefauver. Who's Street?"
"The Tuskegee Airman," Charlie said. "Distinguished Flying Cross."
"Oh, right," she said. "We should have him over for dinner. Is he married?"
"Yes," Charlie said, "with twins. Just born last year." Margaret shuddered a bit.
"Twins? I can't imagine. Let's hope we don't get that lucky," she said with a smile.
"Good God, no. Can't imagine two. I'm terrified of one."
I wonder if people having twins say, the rabbits died, or if they think there were three dead rabbits for triplets.
Good Lord, said Charlie. If it's triplets, I'll have what the rabbits are having.
She chuckled. I've been meaning to ask you, does your office manager have children?
Miss Leopold? I don't believe she's even married. She's never discussed any family. She wears rings, but none on her left ring finger. I can't imagine she doesn't have suitors. She's a knockout for her age, but none that I know of. Why do you ask?
I want to visit your office more, Margaret said. If this is our life now, I need to get to know the people you're working with.
Anytime. It would be great to show you around the Capitol now that I know it better. I'm close to not getting lost on my way to the bathroom.
Knockout, huh? Margaret asked.
For a woman in her 40s, Charlie said, if you like that southern beauty queen type, which I don't. Not that you're not a beauty queen.
Uh-huh, said Margaret, smiling.
You know what I mean, sweetie. I'm going to go to the bathroom. Charlie excused himself from the table.
Good idea, Margaret laughed.
On his way back, Charlie spotted the Kennedys, Jack and Jackie and Bob and Ethel, seated at a more private corner table near the back. Jack and Jackie lived across the street and a few doors down from the Martyrs, on Dent Place, in another federal-style townhouse, a much larger one, of course. After they finished dessert and Charlie paid the check, he suggested to Margaret that they go say hi.
Oh, that seems silly, Margaret said.
Why? We're neighbors. People do say hi, Margaret. She rolled her eyes but relented, as he'd known she would. Even Margaret was not immune to a certain type of luminary. They approached the Kennedys' table. Bob Kennedy looked up and motioned them closer, his grin deployed instantly and convincingly. Charlie couldn't help wondering if he himself would ever possess the same natural ease. It was definitely an asset in this town.
You're Winston Modest, boy, Bob Kennedy said, shaking his hand.
That's right, Charlie said. My wife, Margaret.
So nice to meet you,
Jackie said in her high, almost childlike voice, as she delicately reached out to take Margaret's hand. She was 25, but looked 18.
You must be the zoologist I've heard so much about.
Yes, said Margaret bashfully, unsure of what Jackie had heard and knowing how odd it was for a congressman's wife to have an actual career. Jackie herself had been the inquiring camera girl for the Washington Times Herald, though her career seemed to have ended with her marriage to the senator, as was standard. It made Margaret feel self-conscious, and she wondered if other wives thought her selfish or a freak.
Jack, Bob said, this is the congressman that's taking on Goodstone. Father told us about it.
His older brother nodded and looked appraisingly at Charlie.
I see, he said noncommittally. That was a risky venture, what with General Kinetics making a move on them, Bob said. Lot of money and jobs at stake.
Lot of lives at stake if they keep making cruddy products, Margaret said. Charlie lost a soldier because of one of their gas masks.
Charlie suddenly realized that she'd helped him finish that large carafe of Chianti over dinner. Bob and Jack seemed taken aback at her boldness, but then Jack decided to smile, and Jackie and Ethel and Charlie exhaled. Quite a firecracker, Jack said to his brother, as if the Martyrs weren't standing right there. She's my lodestar, said Charlie, somewhat dramatically, and then, having had his own fair share of Chianti, he found himself reciting a poem he'd read over and over in his tent in France. A star, but no cold heavenly star, a warm red star of welcome in the night. Far off it burned upon the black hillside, sole star of earth and all that waste so wide. A little human lantern in the night, yet more to me than all the bright, unfriendly stars of heaven, so cold and white. He finished, slightly abashed at this impromptu tableside recital.
Who is that? Asked Bob. Gibson?
Yes, sir, Charlie said, and forgive me. The wine. Bob waved his hand to dismiss any self-consciousness.
I'm not acquainted with Gibson, said Jackie.
Wilfred Gibson, said Jack. British poet, served in the infantry on the Western Front in World War I. An admiral gave me a book of his poems after I got back from the island.
Well, it was just lovely, said Jackie.
Thank you, said Charlie. Got me through a few long nights reading Gibson and thinking of this lady here. Margaret smiled indulgently and squeezed his arm lightly, a signal.
Anyway, we've taken up enough of your time. Do you know Alan Seeger? Jackie asked. Is he in Congress? Margaret replied. No, he was in the French Foreign Legion during the Great War, Jackie said. He was killed in Belloy-en-Santerre. She put her hand on her husband's shoulder. He wrote one of Jack's favorite poems. He asks me to recite it sometimes.
Hovid man, said Jack. He joined the Foreign Legion because we hadn't entered the war yet and he wanted to fight. Give us a sample, Jackie.
His wife smiled and began. I have a rendezvous with death at some disputed barricade. When spring comes back with rustling shade and apple blossoms fill the air. I have a rendezvous with death when spring brings back blue days and fair.
She stopped and shrugged, and Bob began to clap. Well done, girl, he said.
Chapter 11. Monday, March 1st, 1954. Morning. Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Margaret sprang from her bed Monday morning at 5:30 as if answering a fire alarm. This was how mornings were for her in this early pregnant state. She snapped from a near coma into high adrenaline alertness. She made her way downstairs and started the percolator for Charlie, turning the nearby wall calendar to March while it brewed. The elm that stood in front of their townhouse was starting to sprout sawtooth leaves. The rising sun illuminated a clear sky. Was spring here? The milk truck veered around the corner onto Dent Place. It belched exhaust, jerked forward, and came to an abrupt stop in the middle of the street. The milkman hopped out of his truck. He emptied a milk churn into 6 bottles and filled his metal carrier. A minute later, he walked up the steps of the martyr's townhouse and shouted out to Margaret. Package on the stoop here, he bellowed. Her previous encounters with the milkman had taught her that he spoke only at top volume. Charlie appeared in the doorway between the stairwell and the kitchen. I'll get it, honey. Margaret turned on the radio. Dent Eisenhower has asked the Republican Senate leadership to put an end to Senator Joseph McCarthy's one-man prosecutorial hearings, the newsman intoned. Reliable sources tell this reporter that the president has beseeched McCarthy's GOP colleagues on the subcommittee, including Senator Everett Dirksen of Illinois, to be present any time McCarthy is presiding over a hearing. Eisenhower's Secretary of the Army, Robert Stevens, last week accused McCarthy of browbeating and humiliating Army off... Charlie turned off the radio and placed a large box on the kitchen counter. On the side was emblazoned the Janus Electronics logo. Charlie retrieved a steak knife from its drawer.
What is it? Margaret asked.
It's, said Charlie, uncertain. He cut open the box, reached into it, and handed her 2 electronic contraptions.
He took the instruction manual out of the box.
It's a baby monitor.
A what?
A baby monitor, Charlie said.
What's that?
Do you remember a few years ago Zenith had the radio nurse? Basically a radio from the kids' room to the living room so parents could hear the baby?
Margaret thought about it for a second.
I don't think so, she said. Apparently it was designed after the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. The original product wasn't very good. It kept picking up other radio signals. Anyway, this is the new technology.
Who's it from?
I think it's from my father, Charlie lied. He thought of LaMontagne's file on Boschwitz, sitting on his office desk, and how whatever he did with it might be wrong. He was holding that dossier roughly an hour later as he made his way from his congressional office to the House chamber, where he and his fellow members had been called for a vote on a bill allowing more Mexican migrant workers into the country. Stopping for a cup of coffee at the House restaurant, Charlie ran into one of his poker buddies, Congressman Chris McLachlan. The Indiana Republican was devouring a cruller while waiting in line for the cashier in the takeout section of the eatery. In his left hand, he held yet another pastry, this one with some sort of red and purple preserves. Hungry? Charlie asked. McLachlan chewed until it was safe to speak.
A tad.
The cashier rang them up, and McLachlan nodded his thanks as he patted his belly, which to Charlie's eye had expanded in the previous month or so. He now looked like someone who had eaten the version of himself depicted in his most recent congressional portrait. McLachlan seemed to be reading Charlie's thoughts, and a sheepish expression crept across his face.
I've got to stop, he acknowledged.
He indicated his half-eaten pastry to Charlie.
Want it?
Charlie shook his head. I've already had breakfast. They walked out of the restaurant. Members of Congress and their aides, journalists, and lobbyists filled the hallways. The 2 congressmen took a left and proceeded up a narrow staircase to the 2nd floor. McLachlan gestured to a step beneath their feet. See those stains? He asked, pointing out clusters of a dozen dark brown splotches on the 7th and 8th marble steps.
Congressman William Talby's blood.
What?
A reporter killed Talby in 1890. Shot him dead right here. Long and seedy story, but bottom line, the reporter wrote about an affair Talby had. Talby beat him up. And then one day the reporter brought a pistol to the Capitol and shot him.
They began walking up the stairs again, McLachlan breathing heavily, removing his pocket square to blot beads of perspiration starting to form on his upper lip.
I definitely do not recall hearing about Talby being murdered right here during my high school tour of the Capitol, Charlie said. But then again, they didn't talk much about the ugly bits.
Huh, no. The tour guides don't talk about it. I've been visiting the members-only collection at the Library of Congress. Fascinating stuff in there. As a scholar, you should really check it out. An incredible collection of history nobody seems to know about.
And there's a section on Talby?
On him and others whose ghosts haunt these halls. Civil War soldiers and the like.
He lowered his voice dramatically.
Some people claim to have seen Talby's ghost right on the stairway.
I never understood the whole ghost phenomenon, Charlie mused. People only claim to see historic figures or those killed under horrific conditions. But what about all the old people who died? If there's a world with ghosts, shouldn't we be constantly walking through hundreds of apparitions of just regular old people?
You raise a decent point, said McLachlan. And it cannot be mere injustice that provokes a haunting. Why, there have been people killed for unjust reasons all over this city. We'd all be haunted day and night. Perhaps it's the specialness of the death that creates the need for a ghost to haunt. And this was odd, a journalist killing a congressman at the Capitol.
And we think today's reporters are rough, Charlie joked.
McLachlan raised an eyebrow.
We do? I don't. You've gotten some tough coverage?
Charlie thought about it. There had been a few vicious jabs at him in tabloid political columns, mostly about his father's role in his appointment and his privileged background. But as a married academic and war veteran with a shiny, clean reputation, he had largely avoided bad ink. The same could not be said for his predecessor, Congressman Van Wagenen, whose reputation was still being dragged through the grimiest mud imaginable, with no lurid rumor spared repetition.
I suppose not, not me personally, Charlie admitted as they continued their journey toward the second floor.
Truth is, most of our so-called Fourth Estate is focused on nonsense, even the ones fixated on McCarthy's Daily Theater. Same so-called journalists he's attacking as commies today were only too happy to give McCarthy's character assassination campaign front-page attention a few years ago, with nary a scintilla of editorial discretion or judgment that what he was peddling was pure balderdash. As if there does not exist such a thing as empirical fact.
You don't think there are Reds in the government, Mac?
Charlie was surprised to hear McLachlan's skepticism about McCarthy, given his deep conservatism and loathing of the godless communists. He'd made a few comments over poker one night about how happy he was that Alger Hiss was in Lewisburg Federal Prison. He'd been imprisoned for perjury since the statute of limitations had run out on his acts of espionage.
I don't care if they get him for jaywalking as long as they get him, he'd said. Of course there are Reds in the government, McLachlan replied. They're infesting it like termites. But McCarthy isn't finding them. Hoover is. McCarthy hasn't produced the name of one proven, clear, actual communist agent. Not one. And that's not even the point. It's a distraction, or, what did Isaiah call it? The old okey-doke. Look over here, and meanwhile your pocket's being picked.
Yeah, he said that about the comic book hearings, Charlie said, wincing a bit internally at the thought of an event he dreaded.
McLachlan patted his shoulder and grinned.
Better you than me, my friend.
Charlie grimaced and followed McLachlan down two hallways of the second floor to the door of the speaker's lobby.
Talking about ghosts, Charlie, John Quincy Adams is said to haunt this room, he said, opening one of the doors.
Charlie peered inside.
In the middle of a debate over some fairly innocuous issue, he had a stroke on the House floor, McLachlan said, pointing at a sturdy couch with light green cushions. The Adams box sofa, where he died. Awful way to go.
Can't think of many good ones, Charlie replied. Hey, where are the Senate bathtubs, the place where Vice President Wilson fell asleep, nearly froze to death, and then died of a stroke?
In the basement somewhere, McLachlan said. The basements here are confusing and they go on forever like ancient caves.
I've heard that sometimes late at night, right outside the room where Vice President Wilson died, folks can catch a whiff of the soap they once used.
Yes, I've heard those tales as well, said McLachlan. And some people claim they hear Wilson coughing. All very silly, like the wails of agony from the ghost of the Union soldier who died in the Capitol Rotunda. The tales are nonsense, but the deaths are very real. And those are just the ones we know about. Think of all the inconvenient people over the years who must have met their ends in this building or nearby and then vanished forever.
Charlie was too startled to ask what in the hell McLachlan was talking about. And anyway, they were now walking onto the House floor where hundreds of members of Congress were convening. They joined a small circle of friendly faces. No one seemed to be paying much attention to the debate at the front of the room about whether or not to allow more Mexican migrant workers into the country. Democratic Congressman Ray Madden was railing against the bill, which he claimed would allow Mexicans to, quote, take over jobs that millions of unemployed Americans are entitled to. On the floor, House Speaker Joe Martin, a Republican from Massachusetts with a boyish face and a mass of hair he always had to brush away from his eyes, was diligently trying to buttress his narrow 7-seat Republican majority by enlisting the support of Southern Democrats, eager to help the farmers and big businesses who relied upon cheap Mexican labor. Strongfellow swung himself over to Charlie on his crutches. Ted Williams broke his collarbone today, Strongfellow said.
How?
Asked Congressman Ben Jensen. He was a mousy Midwest Republican who had served in World War I and loved talking about Iowa.
Shoestring catch, said Strongfellow. Line drive.
He's about 20 pounds overweight, noted Charlie.
Ike is dropping another H-bomb on the Marshall Islands today, said Democratic Congressman George Hyde Fallon, a machine politician from Baltimore. And you fools are talking about Ted Williams' collarbone.
They tried and failed to look contrite. The debate over the migrant worker bill continued with various House deputy whips dispatched to corral votes. Charlie leaned closer to Strongfellow and said in a low voice, Phil, I need a favor.
Anything, he said.
I'm trying to find out about a Pentagon-backed study done at the University of Chicago, Charlie said, reaching into his inside suit pocket to retrieve the notes Bernstein had handed him earlier that day. Something to do with cereal grains and broadleaf crops. It's blocked by wartime secrecy laws. I thought maybe your Armed Services Committee connections could help me get it unblocked.
Done, said Strongfellow, seemingly unsurprised by the request and uninterested in its origins.
Charlie imagined he was used to doling out random favors and just as used to calling them in when he needed to. Strongfellow took the paper Charlie handed him and slipped it into his inside suit pocket, nodded, and shuffled away to talk to someone presumably more important. Charlie took a seat and listened to the conversations fluttering around his head like a flock of startled pigeons.
I'm not going to do it if you're not. I said at least buy me a dinner first if you're going to fuck me, Mr. Chairman.
What do we care about cheap Mexican labor in Maine? Technically, he's a socialist, not a communist, but that's an argument for him to make, not me.
My constituents couldn't give a shit about Syria.
Doris Day, I think.
That hairdo might be the worst cover-up in political history.
McLachlan eased himself into the chair next to Charlie's. It creaked under the sudden weight.
How are you going to vote? He asked.
Not too many crops on the Upper West Side, Charlie said.
That's fine if you don't have national ambitions, McLachlan said. Jack Kennedy's going to get screwed in the Midwest in 56 because of his hostility to my people.
Your people?
Farmers, McLachlan said. Though I suppose this is all going to get wrapped into the farm bill anyway.
When you say these issues are all a distraction, the juvenile delinquency hearings, McCarthy naming names, this migrant debate, Charlie asked, stealing a glance at the file folder on his lap, you're leaving out a key part of the puzzle.
And what's that?
Distraction from what? You think this is all being done to keep our eyes off the ball. What's the ball? Before McLachlan could answer, Charlie heard a tumult above him. He followed the sound to the visitors' gallery, where four tourists were brandishing a Puerto Rican flag.
Viva Puerto Rico Libre! They shouted. Viva Puerto Rico Libre!
Then came sounds, pop, 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 echoing throughout the House chamber. Charlie heard a colleague mutter something about firecrackers, but Charlie knew the sounds, as did McLachlan. It was a gun, more specifically a German pistol, probably a .38.
Members of Congress and their aides were shouting, some running for the exit doors, others hitting the ground or seeking shelter behind chairs or tables. Snapping back to wartime training, Charlie took cover, leaping behind a small oak desk used by House Republican leaders, and assessed the situation. One, then two bullets whizzed past his head. The shots seemed to be coming from the visitors' gallery, and they were clearly being aimed at members of Congress standing on the floor of the House chamber. Were they targeting anyone in particular? He couldn't tell. He heard a grunt and turned around to see blood spreading across the chest of Alvin Bentley, a strapping Michigan Republican with a crew cut and glasses. He fell back on the floor, a confused look on his face. Ben Jensen, whom Charlie had exchanged pleasantries with minutes earlier, fell forward abruptly, blood spurting from his right shoulder. Shot after shot after shot streamed across the floor. It was all happening in just seconds, but it felt endless. Where the hell are the Capitol Police? Charlie wondered. The scene was chaos. Charlie watched in horror as George Hyde Fallon fell to the ground. Seconds later, Cliff Davis, the old Tennessee Democrat who was a former judge and Klansman, was shot in the leg and went down. Charlie, crouched behind the desk, was getting his bearings and trying to figure out how to respond. He locked eyes with Congressman James Van Zandt, a Pennsylvania Republican and Navy captain who had served in both World Wars. Van Zandt pointed to the stairwell that led to the visitors' gallery. Charlie tapped his chest, then pointed up and swirled his finger to suggest motion. He would stand and distract the shooters. Van Zandt nodded. They had a plan. 3, 2, 1. Charlie stood and looked up to the gallery. All four of the Puerto Rican activists, three men and one woman in their 20s and 30s, were brandishing firearms. An elderly tourist was frantically trying to grab one of the guns. He was weak but determined. One of the shooters hit him in the head with the butt of his rifle, sending him falling into the aisle. Two of the shooters spotted Charlie and took aim at him. Charlie faked left and moved right. Van Zandt suddenly appeared in the visitors' gallery and tackled one of them. And before the shooters could respond, a half a dozen Capitol Police officers entered the balcony and descended on them. Charlie ran to Jensen. Isaiah Street was already checking his neck for a pulse. Medic! Charlie yelled as if he were back in France. Medic! But no medic appeared. Somewhere in the distance, a bit bizarrely, Speaker Martin declared the House to be in recess. All Charlie could see was a blur of panicked faces of politicians and pages. The gunfire had ceased. Street, crouched over Jensen, was attempting to plug the bleeding hole in Jensen's shoulder, as if he were a sinking ship. A burly red-headed page, maybe 18, approached Charlie and asked if he was all right. It was only then that Charlie looked down and saw that his white Oxford shirt was soaked with blood. He patted himself down, found no obvious wounds, and continued trying to tend to Jensen with Street. He suddenly wondered what had happened to McLachlan, and turned his head to the spot where the two had been sitting. There he saw McLachlan on the floor, a dark stain expanding at the small of his back, prone and as still as a stone. Chapter 12, Monday, March 1st, 1954, afternoon, Eastern Dispensary Casualty Hospital, Southeast Washington, D.C. Charlie sat in the emergency room examination area, separated from other patients by maroon curtains. A nurse's brief inspection had ended when she concluded that the blood on his shirt wasn't his. She told Charlie to relax and wait for a doctor to discharge him. The surrounding cubicles were full of congressmen who were actually wounded. She scurried off to join the other nurses and doctors tending to them. Charlie lay back on the examination table, listening to the conversations swirling around the busy room, sounding as if they were far away. "Where's the trauma patient?"
"McLachlan, O.R.
"Bad?"
"One bullet lodged in his spine between L2 and 3. Another one shredded his spleen."
"How many congressmen were shot?"
"6 total. 4 here, Jensen and Davis at Bethesda."
"Let me see. Bentley took one to the chest.
He looked dead when he got here."
"He's critical in the O.R. I'd say it's 50-50. Bullet perforated the right lung, went through the diaphragm, liver, stomach."
"Martyr's over there. He's fine. Fallon, bullet through his right thigh. He's stable. Over there, Roberts, shot in his left leg. Bullet entered thigh above knee and went downward. Also stable."
The squeaky wheels of a gurney ripped Charlie out of his dream state. He focused his attention on the examination cubicle to his left, where he could hear Fallon offering faint responses to a doctor's questions. The hospital intercom blared periodic bulletins. A certain doctor was needed in the OR. A different one was needed in the ER. Background beeps from machines were randomly scattered through the area like the sounds of birds and bugs around a campsite.
They just caught a fourth Puerto Rican at the bus station.
Suction, please.
I don't understand. This is about independence?
Something like that.
Doesn't American Sugar own half the island?
I'm not saying they don't have a grievance or two. Hemostat, hold that there. Just like that. Right. Good.
They tried to assassinate Truman.
When was that, 50?
Something like that. Blair House. Killed a cop.
Yes, I remember, because that was the year I got married, and we were going to honeymoon in Puerto Rico, but we had to cancel because of riots.
Well, you know what they say. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
Dr. Klein.
He can't hear us.
Obviously, these are murderous zealots.
I'm just saying they see themselves as Minutemen.
Dr. Klein.
Harriet, I didn't say I see them that way.
Didn't the Puerto Ricans vote not long ago to remain an American Commonwealth? Did I dream that? There are people around.
Whispers.
Hemostat.
Charlie's eavesdropping was interrupted by a sharp voice he recognized.
Can you please just tell me where my husband is?
Margaret!
He stood and poked his head through the curtains. She ran to him and buried herself in his embrace. She pulled away to look at him and then burst into tears.
Margaret, Margaret, I'm okay, he said. This isn't my blood.
She wiped her eyes and took a deep breath.
I've never even heard of this hospital, she said.
It's closest to the capital. She crossed her arms and looked at him sternly.
I was told about your heroics today.
And then she punched him with both fists. Not hard, but not jokingly either. He grasped her wrists and held them gently, lowered his forehead to meet hers. They stayed there silently, the buzz and hum of the hospital noises surrounding them. Both Bentley and McLachlan were still in surgery when Charlie was discharged that evening. In the waiting room, he ran into Strongfellow.
What are you hearing? He asked Charlie.
I overheard a doctor saying Bentley is 50-50, Charlie said. They're even less optimistic about Mac.
Margaret tugged him toward the door.
He shook Strongfellow's hand in parting.
I'll come back in the morning.
A Capitol police officer hailed a cab for the two of them. The car radio was broadcasting news about the shooting.
Could you turn that off, please?
Margaret asked the cabbie, who complied.
They sat in silence for 15 blocks.
Finally, Margaret said, I was talking with my sister on the phone when all of a sudden there was someone at the door. It was Jackie Kennedy. She'd heard what happened and ran over to make sure I knew, so I turned on the radio.
Her bottom lip was quivering. Having been tested at such a young age by her father's death, Margaret was not one for whom tears came quickly.
She looked out the window as Charlie reached to hold her hand. She took it, intertwined her fingers with his.
The reporter on the radio knew nothing. Shooting in the house, at least half a dozen members rushed to area emergency rooms, blah, blah, blah. He seemed far more interested in the assailants than the victims. Puerto Rican extremists, one a woman, a note in her purse said something about her blood, the independence of Puerto Rico, the subjugation of her people. The reporter read every word of the note as if it explained this, as if it justified it. I turned off the radio. It was making me sick.
Charlie noticed her absentmindedly place her left hand over her abdomen, underlining why this had shaken her so badly.
I tried to call your office, the speaker's office, house leadership, the cloakroom, all those numbers you gave me, but all the lines were busy, she went on. Couldn't get through to police, couldn't get through to any emergency rooms.
How'd you find me?
Cheryl Ann Bernstein called me and told me where you were. While I was waiting for the cab, Miss Leopold called to tell me too. They said they'd been trying to call, but the switchboard was jammed.
He gripped her hand more tightly.
I'm so sorry, Margaret. I had blood on me, so they whisked me away. There was no phone for me to call you from. The hospital said they had to keep their lines open. It was total chaos.
But she was looking out the window again, distracted and still angry.
Cheryl Ann told me what you did, to draw fire. You didn't have to be a goddamn hero. Good headlines aren't going to be of any use to a baby without a father. My father got plenty of headlines after the crash. Worthless.
She let go of his hand and continued staring out the window as evening fell upon Washington. He looked out his. It was almost disconcerting, after the violent chaos of the day, to find their tree-lined street and stately townhouse quiet and unaltered under the street lamps. Life had changed forever a few miles away. Here, it was just the same. They got out of the cab and walked silently up the stairs and inside, both too numb to speak more than necessary. While he took a shower, she made soup, and he came down and ate it hungrily. Before long, he had passed out on the living room sofa in front of the gray haze of the television, immune to the comedic charms of Sid Caesar. Margaret woke him and gently guided him up the two flights to their bedroom. Hours later, though it felt like seconds, he was jolted awake by Margaret's hand on his shoulder. He had been dreaming of Private Rodriguez.
Charlie, Congressman Street is at the door.
Charlie sat up and rubbed his eyes. His muscles ached.
What time is it? It's morning.
What does he want?
He wants to bring you to the hospital. Mac is out of surgery, and it doesn't look good.
Charlie dressed quickly and headed downstairs to find Street and Margaret at the kitchen table drinking coffee, their faces somber. Street's eyes met Charlie's, and he gave a small shake of his head. Then he stood up and reached for his fedora. The Capitol Police officer standing guard outside McLachlan's room at Casualty Hospital balked when he saw Street. Other than orderlies and the custodial staff, few non-whites were seen here. Most of the city's black population went to Freedmen's Hospital for medical treatment. "He's a member of Congress, as am I, and we're here to see our friend," Charlie said, and he walked past the guard. Street looked at the police officer, who nodded sullenly in acknowledgement. Inside the dimly lit room, McLachlan lay still, an oxygen mask over his face, his chest slowly rising and falling with each struggling breath. McLachlan's wife sat by his side, her eyes puffy from hours of weeping. She wore pearls and a pink suit, more beltway than Terre Haute. She looked as though she'd been at a Daughters of the American Revolution luncheon when she got word of the shooting the day before.
Jesus, thought Charlie. Was that only just yesterday?
It felt like a month had passed. This was a whole new Washington, D.C. reality to which he hadn't yet adjusted, one where death wasn't something that happened just to our boys in Korea. The tiny room was crowded. House Speaker Joe Martin was standing off to the side, talking to Majority Leader Charles Halleck from McLachlan's home state of Indiana and Democratic Leader Sam Rayburn of Texas. Near them stood the Vice President, Richard Nixon, with a complexion almost as wan as the patient's. Charlie and Street introduced themselves to McLachlan's wife, Henrietta, who struggled to maintain her composure. She raised her hands helplessly.
The idea that he could survive the Nazis in France but not the Puerto Ricans in Washington.
Her eyes darted towards Street, presumably to see if he might have taken offense. But Street's face revealed only sympathy. I've known him for only a short while, Charlie told her, but he is one of the most principled men I've ever met, and he's strong. If anyone can fight this and survive, it will be him. The words rang hollow as he said them. In France, he had seen the mightiest fighters perish in pathetic accidents, and the weakest cowards make it through the grisliest of conflicts. None of it meant anything.
Oh, Congressman Martyr, he has such nice things to say about you, she replied.
The room settled into silence for a few moments, until two staff members poked their heads in the doorway to retrieve Vice President Nixon, followed not long afterward by aides collecting the Speaker of the House. Charlie and Street engaged in some small talk with Halleck and Rayburn.
How are the others? Street asked.
They're okay, Rayburn said. Better than Mac.
We just saw Davis and Jensen at Bethesda, said Halleck. They're sharing a room. Doctors say they're going to be fine.
Some bitches were arguing.
Rayburn chortled softly, casting a cautious glance towards Mrs. McLachlan before he lowered his voice.
Davis wanted to listen to the Lone Ranger on the radio. Jensen wanted music, said he'd had all the shooting he could take for one day.
Charlie smiled politely, too aware of the gravity of McLachlan's situation to feel comfortable joking at his bedside about survivors. He and Street sat down on two metal folding chairs and stared at the patient as he labored to breathe. They didn't know what to say or where to look.
Mrs. McLachlan, Sam and I need to stop by and visit some of the other wounded members of Congress, Halleck said. But we'll be back soon. If there's anything at all we can do for you, please don't hesitate to call.
She accepted his farewell absently with a small nod. The congressmen made their way out of the room, and Charlie turned his attention to the bed. In addition to the oxygen mask, McLachlan had two IVs that were dripping clear fluids into his forearms. Charlie was following the trail of a blue tube from McLachlan's arm through a mess of cords and wires when Street nudged him. McLachlan's eyes were open. His wife jumped to her feet.
Christian? Mrs. McLachlan asked. Christian?
McLachlan didn't move his head or neck. He blinked rapidly, a look of incomprehension on his face. His gaze shifted from right to left, taking in Charlie and Street, and then to his wife. His right hand slowly rose from the bed, and she clasped it with both of hers. Tears began to stream down her cheeks. McLachlan struggled to speak. He laboriously yanked the oxygen mask from his face. His wife gasped and looked at Charlie in street, alarmed. McLachlan, grimacing with pain, turned his eyes to Charlie and sent him a piercing glare.
Jennifer, McLachlan said. Under Jennifer.
He looked depleted by the effort. His eyes closed as the oxygen machine suddenly emitted alarmed, loud beeps. Two nurses and a doctor raced into the room. A nurse replaced the oxygen mask, then looked over her shoulder at Street and Charlie. Gentlemen, we're going to have to ask you to leave, she said firmly. Charlie and Street barely had time to grab their coats before the door slammed behind them.
Jesus, Street said.
Charlie was shaking his head, trying to make sense of what they'd just heard.
Under Jennifer?
Chapter 13. Thursday, March 4th, 1954, morning. Capitol Hill. Charlie felt as spent as a wrung dish rag. He pushed himself up from his chair and dragged himself out of his office to walk to the Capitol. A joint session of Congress awaited him, where he would be treated to a bipartisan welcoming of the Governor General of Canada. Part of Charlie couldn't believe, indeed, was appalled, that so many folks proceeded as if there hadn't been a mass shooting in the House chamber just 3 days ago. It felt as though they were behaving as if the shooting was a normal, if unfortunate, event, a fender bender, a coffee spill, though all six wounded members of Congress remained in the hospital, McLachlan in a coma. Charlie tried to continue his day-to-day activities in a barely awake, zombie-like state he hadn't experienced since France. From the end of the hallway, he heard a familiar voice.
You okay?
He turned around to see Davis LaMontagne and was instantly reminded of the lobbyist's request and the damning folder about Boschwitz, the one Charlie had last seen right before the Puerto Ricans started shooting. In the previous 3 weeks, Charlie had studiously avoided saying anything other than a brief hello to LaMontagne, and here he was to finally force the matter.
Davis, Charlie said. Damn. You didn't give it to anyone? LaMontagne said.
I lost it on the house floor during the shooting, Charlie conceded. LaMontagne's face was hard to read.
I gave you that folder 3 weeks ago. You were still carrying it around Monday?
Yes, said Charlie.
Sorry. And you don't know where it is, I presume?
I don't. LaMontagne's eyes narrowed.
You do know six congressmen got shot, Charlie asked, an edge in his voice. And then McLachlan's probably going to die.
LaMontagne turned around without answering and walked away down the hall. Charlie shook his head in disbelief.
What was all that about?
Charlie turned. Isaiah Street emerged from around a corner of the hallway where apparently he'd heard the exchange.
You know how once you get this job, everybody wants something from you? Charlie asked as the two proceeded down the four flights of stairs.
You bet, said Street.
Everybody from the speaker to my Aunt Estelle.
So? Street prompted as they both stopped on the second floor to light cigarettes.
What's LaMontagne after you for?
He wanted me to provide the McCarthy Committee with some pretty damning information about one of his business competitors.
And is the competitor a Red?
Charlie shrugged as he put away his German lighter.
Dunno. Maybe. I was supposed to give it to Bob Kennedy. 3 weeks ago.
Just taking your time.
I don't know why I was waiting so long.
Yes, you do.
Yes, I do.
Cigarettes in hand, they proceeded down the stairs.
Listen, speaking of requests, I was just about to make one of you, Street said. I want you to use your Manhattan connections to block permitting on a General Kinetics factory they're trying to build in Harlem. Civil rights activists in New York are making this a national cause, so I'm getting heat back home, too.
They want to stop it? They don't want the jobs? I can't imagine Congressman Powell trying to stop any employment opportunities in Harlem.
No, you're right. Powell isn't on board with me here.
So why are you and the civil rights activists opposed?
It's a chemical plant, Charlie. Vinyl chloride.
Charlie looked at him blankly.
Have you ever heard of Mossville, Louisiana?
Where?
The two exited the House office building where tourists were gathering, many living up to their stereotype in gaudy and inappropriately casual dress. Pentax cameras hanging like albatrosses around the necks of the dads. In an apparent show of force in the wake of the shooting, two Capitol police officers stood at the corner. They nodded at Charlie and ignored Street. A chill remained in the air for which the coatless congressmen braced themselves, but the sun was blinding, and spring had unmistakably arrived. They stopped at the crosswalk of Independence Avenue, where the driver of a red convertible Mustang honked at them. It took them a second to realize it was Strongfellow. He stopped his car even though he had a green light.
"Hey, boys," he shouted. "You coming tonight?"
Other cars began steering around him on the four-lane road, some honking angrily. The Capitol Police ignored the transgression.
"How on earth can you afford those wheels?" Street asked him.
"Rights to my life story paid for it," Strongfellow said.
"What do you think of James Dean for the movie?"
"As the car?" Charlie quipped.
"Hardy har har," Strongfellow said.
A dairy truck driver shook a fist out his window as he leaned on his horn, while more cars backed up behind him. Strongfellow maneuvered his way closer to the curb, making it only slightly easier for anyone to pass him.
"I was going to call you, Charlie, to make sure you're coming tonight."
"To what?" Charlie asked.
"Party in Connie Hilton's suite at the Mayflower. Invitation only. Black tie."
"Hilton's throwing a party?" asked Charlie. "What for?"
"Let me guess," said Street, knowing that he wasn't invited for obvious reasons. "For reauthorizing the Mexican migrant workers, so he can keep paying pennies to his hotel maids and kitchen staff."
"Winner!"
shouted Strongfellow, cheerfully oblivious to the traffic chaos he was still causing. A moving van driver blared his horn, leaning out his window and cursing at Strongfellow. It was tough to make out every word of the explosive monologue, but certain terms were loud and clear. Charlie wondered how long Strongfellow might sit there tying up traffic, since law enforcement seemed uninterested in the matter. Strongfellow ignored it all completely.
"Bill got through the Senate and is now on its way to Ike," he said. "I'm not exactly sure who's throwing the party. Some club that Carlin is a member of? Hey, did you hear Senator Lehman claim that 100 commies cross the Mexican border every day?"
100 a day?" asked Charlie, as another car honked at Strongfellow. Charlie felt slightly embarrassed to be part of this spectacle of entitlement. "Where does a claim like that even come from?"
"One's nether regions, I suppose," said Strongfellow.
"And Humphrey backed him," said Street. "He said the Reds have one of their strongest infiltration programs out of Mexico."
"Mexico?" asked Charlie incredulously.
"Kennedy voted against the Braceros bill," Street said. "Kefauver, too. Big labor flexing some muscle."
A heavy-duty Mack truck pulled up behind Strongfellow, and its driver started pounding on the horn. Strongfellow sighed as if to say, "Impatient drivers will be the death of us all," and eased his car into first gear.
"So 9 p.m. at the Mayflower?" Strongfellow asked as he pulled away. "See you there, Charlie."
"Wait, Phil," Charlie began, but it was too late. Strongfellow was already a full city block away, driving as if he were in the Grand Prix. The light turned green and Charlie and Street crossed the street, resuming their walk toward the Capitol. The white and pink buds of the cherry blossom trees were beginning to open. Groundskeepers unfurled rolls of sod to cover the acres of barren, frozen dirt surrounding the Capitol grounds. Turf harvesting was a post-war agricultural development that significantly enhanced the appearance of the Capitol's tourist spots.
"What did you want to ask him?"
"It's dumb. This note I found in my desk maybe belonged to Van Wagenen," Charlie said. "Scribbles about broadleaf crops and the University of Chicago. My intern called and wasn't able to get any information about it because of wartime secrecy laws. Phil said he'd look into it for me."
"Sounds pretty random."
"It is. I don't know much about Van Wagenen. It's probably nothing."
"All I know about him is that his body was found in a cheap hotel room next to a dead hooker. That might be as much as I need to know, to be honest."
Charlie stopped walking and looked at Street, stunned.
"Really? A hooker?
Everything I've heard made it sound like it was suicide."
"Nope," said Street. "They kept it out of the papers. A friend of mine with connections told me. To spare his family, they put the hooker's dead body in a different room."
"And what do they think happened?"
"They have no idea," said Street. "It remains an open case."
"Amazing. A dead congressman is an open case."
"In company towns like this one, or Hollywood, or Detroit, or Nashville, police are often encouraged to let some crimes go unsolved. People in power don't want them solved."
"What?"
"Someday, for kicks, go to the homicide division here in D.C. and see how many dead young women are in the cold case files. Attractive ones. You'll be stunned."
"Right, but Van Wagenen and a dead prostitute? That has to be some form of murder-suicide, no?"
"All I know is what my guy told me. They think he didn't kill her and she didn't kill him. No cause of death. No evidence of sexual contact.
There was no evidence of any relationship at all, actually. No phone records, no witnesses, nothing tying the two together." "Other than their corpses being found in the same room," Charlie said.
"Right," Street laughed. "Except that." It's hard to believe the local police wouldn't care about such a case, Charlie said.
They care, said Street. But when there's a VIP involved, the FBI bursts in and claims jurisdiction, and that's it. We don't hear about it after that. Hoover's own private police force.
They continued into the Capitol building and walked up the stairs to the House chamber. By now, Charlie knew better than to ask Street if he was offended at not having been invited to the party that evening. With the exception of the veterans' poker night, Street shunned most social functions, presumably to avoid the blatant racism so prevalent in Washington. Which wasn't to say he was a shrinking violet. Street ate daily at the purportedly whites-only House dining room, and he didn't give an inch when bigotry reared its head in his presence, routinely challenging the offhand remarks and funny stories that exposed his colleagues' often unwitting, careless prejudices. Did Street care that he wasn't invited to the Bacchanal tonight? He'd already made it clear to Charlie that he far preferred to spend his evenings with his wife and twin baby boys than with most members of Congress.
Honestly, Charlie, most of them are just imbeciles, he said once.
They reached the second floor of the Capitol building, and Charlie paused to look at the immense oil painting of the Founding Fathers that hung on the wall of the landing. As imagined by artist Howard Chandler Christie, George Washington stood on a dais in Philadelphia's Independence Hall in 1787, lit and posed as if God had just handed down to him the U.S. Constitution. James Madison sat in the front row, a worried expression on his face, while front and center sat Alexander Hamilton, whispering into the ear of a lounging Benjamin Franklin. It was a complicated portrayal, half-class photo of almost 40 founding fathers, half-patriotic rah-rah. Since it had been painted 14 years earlier, seen at the signing of the Constitution of the United States, had become one of the most famous works of art in the country. So much had changed since the last time he'd stopped to look at the portrait a few weeks before. He'd been with McLaughlin and Street, all of them on their way from the House chamber to their offices after a vote, Bernstein in tow with a sheaf of phone messages for Charlie's attention.
Hold up, McLaughlin had called out from the second floor as the others headed downstairs. They turned and rejoined him.
McLaughlin was staring up at the painting as he reached into his jacket pocket and pulled out a leaflet.
I've been meaning to get a better look at this. Christie spent years chasing down portraits of all of these men, it says here.
He waved the leaflet toward the painting, then turned with a grin to the others.
Can you name them all?
This a pop quiz, Mac? Street asked.
39 people signed the Constitution. You want me to ID all of them?
Charlie protested. But he accepted the challenge and proceeded to rattle off names with ease, aware that he was showing off but unable to resist.
Okay, that's John Dickinson, Charlie said, walking up a couple of stairs and pointing to the right of Washington's table.
The painting was so enormous the figures were almost life-size.
But that's not accurate. He signed the Constitution by proxy. He wasn't there that day. He was sick.
Not bad, said McLaughlin.
As far as I know, there aren't any portraits anywhere of two of the signers, Jacob Broom and Thomas Fitzsimons, Charlie continued. We, history, have no idea what they look like. So on this, one of them must be that guy whose face is blocked by Charles Cotesworth Pinckney's arm, and the other is next to Dickinson, with just the top of his wig showing. Is that right?
Very nice, Street said, looking over McLaughlin's shoulder at the key.
Charlie had continued to name the signers, frankly enjoying the chance to flex his academic muscles, unused since December exams and, until then, of no interest to his congressional colleagues. He'd been grateful to McLaughlin for allowing the lowliest freshman in Congress a brief moment in the sun. And now, standing in the same spot just a few weeks later, looking up at the immense painting that filled the entire wall, he felt both small and acutely aware of McLaughlin's absence. He had tried to project strength to Henrietta McLaughlin, but he felt as though they both knew she would soon be a widow. Street lightly tapped Charlie's shoulder, seeming to know the reason behind the moment of melancholy, and they resumed their journey. Street led the way and they found two seats in the House chamber. Charlie sat right behind Congressman Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. Charlie thought about the two men and their wildly different approaches to dealing with the ubiquitous racism Charlie had only really started to notice since becoming Street's friend. Street had told him that after Powell was elected to Congress in 1944, Speaker Rayburn had cautioned him not to push matters too quickly.
Adam, everybody thinks you're coming down here with a bomb in each hand. Maybe you are, but don't throw them. Feel your way around. You have a great future.
That had lasted all of 8 weeks, until Powell stood on the House floor and called for the impeachment of a Mississippi Democrat, who said nigger and kike almost as often as he said hello and goodbye. Beyond their race and job,
Street and Powell had not much in common. For one, no one would ever mistake Street for a white man, as happened with Powell. In that, Street's election by the good people of Chicago's North Side, academics and liberal Jews, in addition to a sizable black population, was a radical act for an era when Lena Horne was considered exotic. At Colgate, Powell had been able to pass